with all the new changes around my house, and with my previous job as a hospice chaplain, I came across a lot of time to think about a subject which came across my path quite often over the last 5 years, and that is of class. And so the title of my sermon is Upper, Lower, Middle Meaning. I came across a lot of situations and a lot of times that made me think of this, and so I found it that I was ready to finally write something on it. And when I was in seminary at Meadville Lombard, class was often a topic, although I have to admit that I didn't like the topic and often actively tried to change it. My best friend, the Reverend Dr. Curtis Carroll, was always on about class. Curtis, do we have to talk about class again? But Curtis was from Louisiana, and he was from a rather poor rural Louisiana, and done two things to bring class in the front of his mind. He'd worked as a Methodist parish pastor for many years in northern Louisiana, and also worked in the, you'll love this, Dr. Glossop, the United Nations Refugee Office. And he got to see a lot of different situations. Curtis knew a great deal about class, and he wrestled with class in a way that I kind of am now. Social class, privileged class, cultural class, intellectual class, so many classes get mixed up, mashed up, and put together these days. I mean, look at this church. Look around you and see the mixture. But how many of you internally winced when I asked you to look around and see the mixture? We Unitarian Universalists don't really like to distinguish, to, dare I say it, judge others like that. And I get it. I want to maintain a world without judgment. I want to believe in a world where I'm accepted and welcomed. And I think it's super important in a congregation to be accepted and welcomed. As a matter of fact, I'd say it's an intentional focus of ours, and that's really something I love about this special place, as Stephen Mead used to say. But judging happens, and it happens all the time, whether we wish it or not. We religious liberals can judge just as harshly. Ask any Republican or conservative Unitarian Universalist, they will tell you that they often feel ostracized or looked down upon. To illustrate this, we can do a bit of a circle of truth, as a colleague of mine used to say at Seasons Hospice. And I'm going to ask for your interaction. I'd like to come back at me honestly with what comes to mind when I say these words. So when I say a word, I just shout it out. Upper class. Rich. What else? Snooty. 1%. Okay. Greedy. Any others? Privileged. Okay. Here's another one. Elite. What do you think of? What comes to mind? Elite. What?
Unfamiliar.
Country club.
Ivory tower.
Excellent. Okay. Occupy.
Wall Street.
That's each one. Or occupy anything. No, it's a big term. Lower class.
Working.
Poor.
Blue collar.
Trailer. Okay. Working class. We already kind of mentioned it. Working class.
Struggling.
What? Labor. Okay. How about middle class? Disappearing.
Spendable.
Strong. What?
Rat race.
Buffer. Haves.
Them. Have mores.
Have nots. What about have nots? Okay. All right, this is a good one. This moocher class. Fox News. Yeah, that's what I think of when I... What? Okay. See, these are all judgments. Good or bad. They're judgments that we made attached to words. So how do we square judgments with our Unitarian Universalist aspirations, our principles and purposes? The hymnal's in front of you. Go ahead and take them out. The gray hymnal. Open them, I think it's about page 6 or so, right before the first hymn, hymn number 1. Find the principles and purposes page. It says, we the congregations of... Okay. Go ahead and read that first paragraph about human dignity and worth and those. Just glance through it. You got it? Found it. Yeah, it's just before page 1. Yep. That's right. That's right. Right there. We, the member congregation, read this paragraph right there, just real quick. Okay, and as you're reading, I'd say those are about as anti-judgment and open and affirming as we can be, right? I mean, we're inclusive, we love and value everybody, it's all cool, it's all good, it's the world we want. But when I look around the room, I see difference, or as we like to say, diversity. Judgment is still going to come into play at some point. Who we're going to love, who we're going to value, cherish, support, comes from a very active form of judgment. But again, how do we square judgment with justice and equity for all? How do they square it in the past? Well, they managed a few solutions to the problem. Since we Unitarian Universalists used to be two different faiths, let me take them apart and address them separately. Then I'll mash them back together and see what we get. And as a bonus, I will prophesy about what we're going to, where we're going in the future. And I couldn't help myself because I've always wanted to say prophesy from the pulpit. I'll go with the Unitarians first. The Unitarians talk a great game, but they didn't even try to address class until the late 19th century, and with the social gospel movement. We'll talk about that in a minute. But let me back up. Here's a quick elevator definition of Unitarianism. And sorry for those who don't know that phrase. An elevator definition is a definition that's done in the time it takes for an elevator to go up a few floors. It's a very quick snapshot. Unitarianism is a quite old heresy, actually, which denies the Trinity of Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. It found the division unscriptural and theologically problematic. Thus, Unitarians believe in one or a unitary God. Okay, we got that? Now, when you take this basic belief and run it through the mill of real life, what you get is a product of belief, like wheat being ground into flour. That flour makes bread or cookies or whatever. That flour can be likened to a term which I adore. It's theological anthropology. And theological anthropology is how the divine and the human worlds mix together. Okay? That flower or that base belief system of ours is mixed with other elements to form different outcomes like bread. Okay? And in this case, base beliefs get run through the mill of real life and outcomes a product. Now with Unitarianism, if you don't have God, Jesus, and the Holy Ghost being equal, it necessitates a hierarchy. Now, again, this is the classical definitions of Unitarianism. It's not where we are now, okay? So don't start giving me the stink eye. Father, Son, Holy Ghost, stepwise. And if Jesus is not God, then Jesus was a man, a great man, they maintained, classical Unitarians did, one to be followed. Look at the Bible that Thomas Jefferson put together, okay? Thomas Jefferson took the four interpretations of the Bible that he could get a hold of And he went crazy with the scissors and the paste, and he cut and pasted his own version of the Bible. And what he stripped away was all the miracles. Because what he was trying to do was come up with the philosophy of Jesus, which is what he felt was important. So you take the divinity out, and then you get the exemplar of Jesus. And that exemplar is the one we were to aspire to. But during that period, we'd gone through centuries of people like Calvin and the likes telling us that we are deprived and lowly people. But along comes the heyday of Unitarianism and the founding of this nation, and we have the product, the cake, if you will, of self-determination, that we can govern ourselves, that we can produce great works by ourselves, that we have agency, that we can cut and paste the Bible and come up with a better temporary meaning. Meaning, I can have a great effect on the outcome of my situation, agency. The great Protestant work ethic is affirmed. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. If Jesus could do it, so could we. The personal responsibility Protestant work ethic stuff that conservatives are espousing to justify the reduction in food stamps has roots, in a small part, in our Unitarian belief system. I know that's hard to swallow. We Unitarians at the founding of this nation pushed personal responsibility and self-reliance in matters spiritual and theological. Jesus figured it out, so can we. It was the trajectory of the Protestant Reformation that we were on. Now, going back to class, I'm sure you can immediately see that Unitarianism was the favorite theology of the elite, the upper class of Boston. Although it wasn't all elitism. Think about the movie. How many of you have seen the movie Amistad? You seen the movie Amistad? Okay. Amistad was a movie about John Quincy. It's a real life event. John Quincy Adams, a Unitarian, fights in future present, fights and wins a legal battle on behalf of black slaves on the ship Amistad. He did this because of these Unitarian beliefs that those captured Africans had inherent worth and dignity, as we would say now. So there are wonderful things that came out of this theological trajectory. But when you believe tremendously in human agency or power to control situations, you can also develop a blind spot to human suffering and tragedy. If an individual has the ability to change their circumstances, then those who do not have good circumstances are either from this trajectory, lazy or ignorant, or may deserve to be in that lower station. Do you see that? How that trajectory leads to that? We, the elite Unitarians, in our noblesse oblige or noble obligation, should support charity and provide minimally for the less fortunate. This was the belief. This attitude exists still, though, in many of our churches. There's a church that I know of that has a wonderful social time making sandwiches for the food pantry, and then one person delivers them to the shelter. It keeps the poverty, those people, at arm's length. We don't want them in our congregation, in our building. They are dangerous, they smell bad, and might harm our children. Now, what's really bad is that's an actual quote that a woman said to me 2 years ago from this congregation. Incidentally, I love the fact that we in this congregation, as far as I know, have never been like that. Now, it may have been previously, but the congregation I know has not been that way. That we invite those people, not even those people, we invite guests into our church home, in our spiritual home. But going back, so the upshot of the Unitarian theological anthropology, or that trajectory, is the raising up of human potential and agency. Be all that you can be, as the Army says. But if you're obviously not all you can be, it's probably your fault. I might assist you, but really, you just stay over there. That's the result of that trajectory. Universalism, on the other hand, was the belief that Jesus saved us all, forward and back in time. Jesus saved the lot of us, because we're all screwed up, and thank God With this, we can all go to heaven. Scripturally, there is support for this theology. While I was growing up in the religiously charged atmosphere of Tulsa, Oklahoma, land of the televangelists, there was a great megachurch preacher I used to hear, Carlton Pearson. And man, could this guy preach. I could sit there and listen to him preach from the phone book. About 20 years ago, Pastor Pearson had an epiphany and realized the truth of the universal gospel, that a just and loving God accepts us all. He embraced universalism and promptly lost his pulpit. For years, actually, he held a service at All Souls Unitarian Church in Tulsa, which is the world's largest brick and mortar UU church. But you can now immediately see that universalism, universal acceptance into heaven by God, would benefit the working and the lower classes. Everybody gets in. Everybody is saved. Everybody is free in the end, free from suffering, free from sin. Jesus paid the price for it all. Just hold on, and everything will work out in the end. Death and glory was actually a universalist battle cry. You die, and then you go to glory. Now, I happen to love the universalist acceptance and grace message because I feel screwed up, messed up, incomplete, flawed, and it comforts me greatly to feel divine acceptance and the acceptance motif from others. I love it. But the fly in the ointment or batter, since we're playing with the whole mill flower motif, is we lose agency, or the ability to control and have effectiveness. Universalism can give up trying to improve things. Just hold on and you will go to heaven is the upshot of universalism. But the drive to improve or even the belief that you can push towards the divine is gone because Jesus paid the whole tab. This is, again, the classical universalist trajectory. Now, in fairness to both Unitarianism and Universalism, they worked a lot jointly on their class problem during a movement called the Social Gospel Movement. And what's really fun, actually, is on NPR, you can catch the grandson of Walter Rauschenbusch. It's a name you can't forget, right? Rauschenbusch. Every now and then you can hear, I can't remember what his name is, but Rauschenbusch. That's the grandson of the kind of godfather of the social gospel movement, Walter Rauschenbusch. Walter Rauschenbusch, during the last part of the 19th century, started this movement. Social gospel proposed that we can improve the lot of the poor and improve all people by creating and maintaining better social systems. We can have hospitals, roads, social institutions, aid societies, temperance, suffrage, things we totally take for granted now arose in great part, the modern forms of them arose during this great liberalization of society. The theological issue of this drive was the social gospel. Both Unitarians and Universalists were heavily involved in this, but in different ways. All this work on social issues finally brought Unitarianism and Universalism so close that they decided to join as one. And today you have, in reality, I think, more of a faith designed for the middle class, a faith that strives upward to improve agency or personal effectiveness, but also accepts and strives towards inclusivity. Open the hymnal again and look at those principles and purposes. Do you see the mix now? Do you see the blend? Upward focus, we can do it, but everybody should be included in it. Yet now we are in a postmodern world of gray in reality. Those are wonderful words there, our principles and purposes, and they inspire me, but we have to face reality. It's a crappy, harsh world out there, and I would venture to say that everyone in this room has been abused by, used by, and disappointed by this world we face. We can no longer say that our kids are going to have it better. I don't think they are. We could try our best to prepare them, but I will admit that many times I feel lost and helpless. Helpless, really, and I guess that's why universalism is appealing to me a lot lately. I feel comforted that I'll be accepted. I want to be accepted and loved by whatever it is out there. Even though I personally don't believe that the tab was paid for by Jesus, I go Unitarian on that. Jesus, for me, was an exemplar, a social justice exemplar. But the world is rapidly splitting between the 1% haves and the 99%. And we have haves and a great number of have-nots. And in an article I read just last night on Facebook, it identified a new category. Well, maybe it's not new, but it's the first time I saw it. Used to haves. Oh, yeah. See, that got some action there. And I'm sure we've got stories in this room. But regardless, it's scary. So where does our faith lead us now? How will we navigate this frightening new world that we have grown into? And to be honest, I'm not sure. We can take from the lessons of the past, for instance, Unitarians. We can utilize the good and bad from the Unitarians and Universalists. We can keep striving to improve and affect change while not being blind and insensitive and callous to others. We can accept and love all, extending to all dignity and worth without giving up on improving our lot or the lot of others. But I'll be honest, I'm not seeing a way that's fitting with these old ways. I have a new favorite show, and I think many of you share this with me. It's Downton Abbey. If you don't know Downton Abbey is a show about English moneyed aristocratic family in their manor house, with the drama upstairs and downstairs between the family and the servants. In the show, though, you can see class and social change happening. Women are getting jobs in this. This is turn of the century and around World War I. Women getting jobs. Branson, the chauffeur, runs off with Lord Grantham's daughter. Branson is always going on about social justice and change in Ireland. And he's talking about socialism and class. And you can see the hints of things to come in this show. See, the change is happening, and you get hints. And in my own life, I sense hints. And I challenge you to look in your own life for those hints of change happening. Again, honoring that diversity between us all. I'm not going to be like the pastor or the minister of past who tell you what you're supposed to see. I can only say what I see, and you see what you see, and hopefully we can work together. But I see access to internet and instantaneous knowledge acquisition as a total game changer. Marty had a set of Encyclopedia Britannicas next to her dining room table growing up, and they would consult the Encyclopedia Britannica whenever there was a question. They would look it up in the encyclopedia about whatever they were talking about, if they could. But there's hardly a night now when my family doesn't check up something on the computer in the kitchen, next to the kitchen table, or look up a YouTube video. Knowledge and ideas are moving at light speed. And it's incidentally why I think conservatives are screeching so loud these days. It's moving and changing too fast. The faster the change goes, the louder they get. I'm not saying that they're wrong, but I think you may have noticed that the tone and timbre of what we're hearing, especially from Fox News, has raised. Again, I'm not saying they're wrong. But where I find hope for the future in all of this, where I get the clues, is in watching my children and the kids of others. Look how fast and quick they are mixing artistic and intellectual mediums. They make music, art, thought so creatively and innovatively and in ways that I can hardly conceive of. And I'm continually stunned when one of my kids says, "I know that song," or they've heard that movie or can quote something back to me, Or they'll take a concept that I've just said and they'll go, oh, that's like this. And they'll quote some other movie or sing some song. I'm like, I don't even know that song. And so we go to the computer in the kitchen and we look up YouTube videos and then we go back and forth like that, exchanging context, exchanging ideas. And we develop, and we develop quickly. Now, it's true that internet is not available to everyone, but the advent of smartphones has gone a long way towards democratization and the leveling out of what used to be very solid class lines. Just a century and a half ago, think about this, if I were growing up a century and a half ago in Tulsa, Oklahoma, I would have had very little exposure to classical music, I would probably imagine. Actually, probably none. And yet, I went on to get a degree in French horn performance. I hadn't really listened to jazz or soul much until about 10 years ago. My kids now have an immense knowledge of music because they have access and they explore. I believe the internet is going to change class and social structures of our society. Now, this is another moment of interaction. And I would like you to think rigidly for a moment. Set yourself within hard boundaries of the old world kind of social class. And think about the characteristics when I say these. What are the characteristics of upper class? Wealth. Power. Privilege. Education. What?
Country club.
Okay. What are the characteristics of the middle class?
Workers.
What?
Workers.
Okay. Working. Beer. Diligence.
Fear.
Interesting. Okay.
School.
Public. Okay. Lower class.
Crime.
Hopeless. Struggling.
Scary.
Okay. Now think about the characteristics of our youth culture. Okay, let's hear some. When you think of youth, how are the youth? What are the characteristics?
Opportunity.
Okay. What characteristics?
Open,
accepting, adaptable, cynical, okay.
Spoiled,
okay. I also see them being very, okay, less judgmental, more open, that's good.
Experimental,
innovative. I like their ability to compile and coalesce and take myriad data and fit it together in new ways. Okay, well, yeah, what are their challenges? The characteristics of their challenges. Short attention span. I think they're disappointed easily.
I don't know if it's a disadvantage, but they're changing the way we communicate.
Changing the way we communicate. Good.
And change is coming quickly.
Right. And I think they can get discouraged easily sometimes.
Yeah, I think they're impatient.
Impatient. Bingo. Bingo. When we talk about these characteristics, think back to Downton Abbey and how we got hints of what was going on, what the issues were, the good and the bad from Downton Abbey. Think about what we just said and put that. It's the thought for you to think about as what is to come. Those characteristics are going to shape the class structures of the future. Those who have access to information, those who can quickly coalesce disparate ideas, those who become discouraged quickly will fall behind. Those who cannot have access or don't have access to these skills will fall behind. It will start to stratify based upon those lines. Now, what I've done is actually just an example. I crowdsourced you to work on a problem, getting input, assessing, putting together, trying to get a temporary better, something that makes a bit more sense. I didn't tell you what the answer was like a minister would have in the past. We kind of found that temporary discussion together, utilizing our unique diverse tools. I have skills, you have skills, I have challenges, you have challenges, but we work together inclusively to develop. And I would say that what we are seeing now in the future is the development of a whole new class, the development of a meaning class, interactive, inclusive, adaptable. This class of people makes the best of their circumstances and infuses their situation with meaning, be it art, music, word, thought, care. And we in this congregation are engaged mightily in this personally and in this place of gathering, our special place. Now, I've pointed to something, but I'm not going to go any further. We must go together into this world, and frankly, as in generations before, we must look to the young to guide us, but we must also look to the old to guide us, and we must look to the middle-aged to guide us, because guidance is now everywhere in almost every form, and we have access to that guidance like we never have before. But through it, we must keep moving forward in love, grace, and acceptance.